actually two doctrines that were unique and separate from each other that were defined as the doctrine of two powers by the rabbis of the first century. The earlier doctrine is the one that we're going to focus on. This was defined in the Jewish Tanaitic period from 30 BC to 200 AD, and it was a doctrine of two complementary powers working side by side together in congruence with one another. The belief in a second being, who was Yahweh's partner, vice regent, or vizier, believed to have divine attributes that were thought only to be possessed by the supreme God, Yahweh. And the proponents of this belief system were Hellenistic Jews, which probably won't come as a shock to some of you, mystical and or apocalyptic Jews, and rogue rabbis. The later belief, that was also termed as the doctrine of two powers, was two opposing powers, gets into Gnosticism, more really heavily Greek influence. I'm not going to really get into that, I just wanted to make you aware that there were two separate belief systems that we refer to this way. So again, we're going to be referring to, or focusing on, the earlier defined doctrine. Now the belief of two powers and the rabbinic refutations of it can be found throughout their preserved texts that have been handed down to us today, such as the Midrash, the Talmud, the Mishnah, etc. We won't be going over every single reference to the two powers in the rabbinic writings. It's important to note that this belief system is referenced throughout their literature literally dozens of times, as you can see on this chart. This is just a chart I put together. There's a lot of information here. If anybody wants a copy of the chart, I'd be happy to supply them with it after the presentation. But this doctrine is all over the place in the rabbinic writings. At this time, what I'd like to do is quote one example where this doctrine of two powers is addressed in the rabbinic texts. This particular one describes what the rabbis believe would be the punishment of those who believe in two powers. In Deuteronomy Rabbah, we read, "And meddle not with them that are given to change." And their interpretation of this proverb was, "Do not meddle with those who declare there is a second God." Rabbi Judah, son of Simon, said, "Scripture says, and it shall come to pass that in all the land, says the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die." They interpreted that as meaning the mouths that declare there are two powers shall be cut off and die. So you can see that the rabbis did not like this doctrine at all that was held by various other Jewish sects. Now, some specific characteristics of this two-power belief. Yahweh was the supreme God who was uncreated from the dawn of time. There was another divine being who was Yahweh's partner, vice regent, or vizier, who was Yahweh's principal agent in creation, communication, and rulership. This second power was identified as one of the following two beings that was speculated on extensively in Second Temple Judaism, either a messianic figure or a mediatory figure. Now, who were the proponents of this two-power belief system? Hellenistic Jews. Hellenistic Jews were Jews that lived in the Greek world, the biggest concentration of which being in Alexandria, Egypt. They were influenced by varying degrees by the Greek culture around them. There were mystical and apocalyptic Jews. These names sound somewhat scary and maybe strange, but mystical and apocalyptic Jews were Jews who speculated heavily on the apocalypse, the end of the age, eschatological themes, destruction of the wicked, the triumph of the righteous, talked about the heavenly realms and who was in these heavenly realms surrounding Yahweh and what their purposes were. And the final group is rogue rabbis, rabbis that despite repeated warnings of staying away from this belief system, some rabbis adopted it. So in order to get a fuller and more comprehensive understanding of what this two-power belief system consisted of, we're going to have to go into some intertestamental books, books that were written between the Old and New Testaments by some of these various Jewish sects. As I said earlier, the doctrine of two powers was directed towards those who believed in either a messianic pre-existent figure or a mediatory pre-existent figure. So I'm going to address those two groups separately in the following sections. I've titled Part 3, Messianic Expectations in Second Temple Judaism. And the points that we'll cover here are there was no one standard view of the Messiah in first century Judaism. Apocalyptic and mystical Jewish texts from the intertestamental period provide evidence that one Jewish expectation of the Messiah included a divine pre-existent warrior based on Daniel chapter 7. The rabbis argued that if you believed in a pre-existent Messiah, then you were an adherent of the two powers doctrine and were therefore a heretic. The New Testament documents portray Yeshua as the Messiah in the apocalyptic sense. The Pharisaic expectation of the Messiah was that of a mere human being in the tradition of the Bar Kokhba revolt. So moving forward, the Gospels show that Palestinian Jews, from scholars to peasants, understood the term Messiah and understood some of the expectations that were believed to be fulfilled by him. I have some examples up here from disciples all the way down to scholars. Everyone, every Jewish person in the land of Israel was fairly familiar with the Messiah, even Romans. Some of the shared characteristics that they believed the Messiah would have were that he would be of the Davidic lineage, Elijah would herald his coming, there would be this world conflict that would rage between Rome and Israel, worldwide exodus, the lost tribes would return. Many of the themes that we see repeated throughout the prophets were standard beliefs and expectations of the Messiah in first century Judaism. Now, although there were common expectations that were shared about the Messiah and the Messianic age that would follow his rule, there existed a wide and varied view of certain specifics, such as the Messiah's origins and his unique characteristics. We're able to get a glimpse into the diverse opinions about their expected Messiah from the rabbinic, pseudepigraphic, and apocryphal texts that have survived to our day. These are books that were written primarily between the Old and New Testaments, some during and after the New Testament, but primarily between the Old and New Testaments. This chart, you can see, I've broken down into three periods, and you see some expectations that they had of the Messiah. Some of them expected just a purely human king, others a divine pre-existent figure, and it varied from group to group. If you'll look into Messianic expectations in a number of scholarly books, you'll find similar quotes as the following. There was no one orthodox notion of the Messiah. There was a wide and varied view, as I said earlier. Now, where did some of these Jewish authors get this idea of a pre-existent Messiah from? Well, they looked at passages such as Micah, where it says, your goings forth are from old, from eternity, or from everlasting. They interpreted that meaning as the Messiah was coming from, his origins were from long ago, perhaps even before the dawn of mankind. Again, Psalm 110 was used as another source showing where the Messiah's origins were from the womb of the morning or the dawn. The Septuagint has from before the morning star, etc. But most importantly for their doctrine of a pre-existent messianic figure was probably Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel 7 we read, I watched until thrones are put in place and the Ancient of Days was seated. And then further on it says, one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. So this passage is believed to be pivotal for those Jews that did believe in a pre-existent Messiah among various scholars. So although the rabbis declared it to be heretical, there were certain Jewish groups that believed in a pre-existent Messiah. As you can see, First Enoch was one of these sources, one of these books that were authored, believed by an apocalyptic Jew. Now, the book of First Enoch is broken up into various parts, each authored by a different author. The chapters that I'm going to be going through are included in chapters 37 through 71, and it's believed that this was authored between 105 and 64 BC by an apocalyptic Jew almost 100 years before the appearance of the Messiah by conservative estimates. So I'm not going to be reading through every single line of these quotes. I'm just going to read some of the highlighted portions just to give you an idea of their perception of what the Messiah would be when he did appear on earth. Just, again, further information on the book of First Enoch. And it reads, the Son of Man was given a name in the presence of the Lord of the Spirits before the beginning of days, even before the creation of the sun and the moon, before the creation of the stars. He was given a name in the presence of the Lord of the Spirits. And then further on it says, he became the chosen one. He was concealed in the presence of the Lord of the Spirits prior to the creation of the world. And again, at the end of the passage, we see that it's referring to his Messiah. So in this passage, some ideas of pre-existence are given to us. Further on, and in First Enoch chapter 62, we read, the Son of Man will be sitting on his throne of glory. And then further on, for the Son of Man was concealed from the beginning, and the Most High One preserved him in the presence of his power. Then he revealed them to the holy and the elect ones. So again, this concept of the Messiah was created, he was concealed from the beginning, but at the proper time he will be revealed to those that are holy. And another dominant theme that we read in the book of First Enoch that's very important for this study is the fact that the Messiah would be enthroned in the heavens. In this passage we see in the highlighted text, and he sat on the throne of his glory, and the sudden judgment was given unto the Son of Man. And further on, for that Son of Man has appeared and has seated himself on the throne of his glory. This is very important for the doctrine of two powers, as we'll see very soon. And finally it says, in those days the elect ones shall sit on my throne. And that's Yahweh speaking in this passage. So inferring that even the Messiah would sit on Yahweh's throne itself. So the interpretation of Daniel 7 offered by the author of 1 Enoch and other apocalyptic writings of the period where the Son of Man is presented as a pre-existent divine Messiah who would be enthroned either alongside God or on Yahweh's throne itself was considered to be heretical by the Pharisaic rabbis of the Tanaitic period, which again is 30 BC through 200 AD. According to the rabbinic doctrine, to believe, teach, or write that another pre-existent heavenly being was enthroned alongside Yahweh meant that you believed in two gods or two powers in heaven. And I have here a quote from the Babylonian Talmud that says, it is taught as a tradition that on high, meaning in the heavens, there is no sitting. And what they mean by that is there is no enthronement other than God's. You could read a number of scholarly resources that refer to this doctrine of the Pharisees. This one I picked out from the Jewish Roots of Christological Monotheism, and it reads, the only throne in heaven is God's. God alone sits, while the angels who attend him are regularly described as standing, meaning the posture of servants. And further on down, even the most exalted of angels, the archangels, do not participate in God's rule, but function as servants, standing, ready to carry out his orders. It was very important to the Pharisaic rabbis that this being was not enthroned, he was standing, because enthroned implied that he participated in a very significant way in Yahweh's divinity. So they always depicted all other beings as standing in the heavens, only Yahweh himself was enthroned. Now, this presented a problem for the passage in Daniel 7 that we referred to earlier, because it says, I watched until thrones were put in place and the Ancient of Days was seated. We can look at many of these quotes from the Brinnick sources that seem to indicate that those who believed in two powers believed that one of the beings, specifically this messianic pre-existent figure, would be enthroned along with Yahweh in the heavens. One passage I would like to refer to in the rabbinic writings is in the Babylonian Talmud, Sanhedrin 38b. There is an argument here between some of the rabbis and some of these that believed in two powers, here referred to as the Manim, which is a fairly generic name given to those who belong to various Jewish sects. There's a lot more to that term, but we can't really get into that here. In any case, in this passage, one of the rabbis is debating with one who believed in two powers. And the person that believed in two powers used as support for their belief system quotes from the Old Testament that seemed to indicate that there was more than one divine being, but there were plural words used. This rabbi then proceeded to quote counter passages to this person, saying that while there are plural forms of these words used, there's also a singular form of this word used, meaning that God is one. So in any case, just to give you an example, I'm just going to read a couple. It says, Rabbi Yohanan said, in all the passages which the Manim or sectarians have taken as grounds for the heresy of two powers, their refutation is found near at hand. Here is one that the two powers proponents used. Thus, let us, plural, make man an image. The rabbi then counterquotes another passage saying, as a counter, and God created singular man in his own image. So these two power proponents would say, well, he said, let us make man in our image, referring to two powers, two divinities. But then the rabbi says, but then it says that God created man singular in his own image. So then it goes on further and continues to quote these plural forms and then singular forms as a refutation. And then finally we have at the bottom of the passage where we come to Daniel chapter 7 verse 9, he quotes, it says, until thrones, plural, were put in place, and one singular that was ancient did see. So again, going over this concept that although there are some plurals, there's also a singular form that follows nearby. So then the question is asked, so why were these plural words necessary in the first place? And the answer is given, to teach the dictum that the Holy One, blessed be he, does nothing without consulting his heavenly court, for it is written, the matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the Holy One. So in other words, what he's saying is that Yahweh is conferring with his divine council, this entourage of elder angels that were around him. And that's why he used these plural forms. We got a glimpse into this entourage of angels in the book of Revelation, where the 24 elders are seated in a circle around the throne of God. So that's what the rabbi is saying. He's saying when they use these plural forms, when Yahweh uses these plural forms, he's not talking to another divinity. He's talking to his divine entourage of angels. So then we continue on in the passage. It says, that is satisfactory for all these other verses, but how do you explain until thrones were put in place? Because the rabbinic doctrine was that only Yahweh himself was enthroned. So what was this other throne for? What was the purpose of this other throne since only Yahweh was enthroned? So we go on. It says, one throne was for himself and one was for David, meaning the Messiah. Even as it has been taught, one was for himself and one for David. And this is presented as Rabbi Akiva's view. However, another rabbi opposed him and said, "No, Akiba, how long are you going to blaspheme the Shekinah?" In other words, what this rabbi is saying is it's absolute blasphemy to say that the Messiah is going to be enthroned with God. That's unacceptable. Rather, one for justice and one for mercy. Did he accept this answer or not? Come and hear, for it has been taught. One is for justice and the other is for charity. This is Rabbi Akiba's view. So in other words, at first, Rabbi Akiba held the same view as those of two powers and said that the second throne is for the Messiah. The first throne is for Yahweh. And the other rabbi said, no, no way, that is blasphemous. You can't say something like that. So then Rabbi Akiba changes his view. And then further on we read, confine yourself to the study of Nagaim and Oholot. You're saying, you know what, Rabbi Akiba, don't even speculate about these prophetic matters anymore because you're just going to get yourself in trouble. Just look into the Torah, into the laws, and you'll be good there. And they go on to say that one throne was actually for mercy, another throne was for justice. In other words, when Yahweh was going to dole out mercy, he would sit on the one throne and be merciful to people. When he was going to dole out justice and be harsh, he was going to sit on the other throne. So I know that some of this is somewhat complicated with rabbinic writing. They don't write very clear, and it takes a little bit to get used to, perhaps. In any case, we can derive the two main points from this passage. Those who believe in two powers use the plural forms of Hebrew words in passages where God is referred to as proof of their position, and those who said a second throne in heaven was reserved for the preexistent Messianic Son of Man are committing blasphemy. So if you remember earlier, we had read things from the book of 2nd Enoch, or 1st Enoch, rather, that said that this messianic figure was enthroned in the heavens alongside Yahweh. From this passage and others in the rabbinic writings, we can see that those people that believed that the Messiah both pre-existed and that he was enthroned, they would be accused of blasphemy. So the Pharisaic expectations of the Messiah did not agree with these apocalyptic versions, such as the one that we read in 1st Enoch. There are many other passages that we could refer to from apocalyptic books from this intertestamental period. The Pharisees believed in a purely human Messiah. And in fact, there was one who was declared to be the Messiah in 132 AD by Rabbi Akiba. This was Shimon Bar Kokhba. He was the proclaimed Messiah at that time. He had used guerrilla tactics against the Roman oppressors and was actually making a lot of headway until he finally got crushed by the Romans. In any case, that was their perception of the Messiah, a human being who was going to come to use guerrilla tactics against the Romans, and then he would be thrown in Jerusalem. The apocalyptic Messiah, however, that these apocalyptic and mystical Jews believed in, this would be a Messiah that came from the heavens, he would defeat all of his enemies by the powers of these divine powers, and then he would enthrone himself with God in the heavens. So we have this two opposing views. The Jews, or the Pharisees rather, who believed he would be seated on a throne on earth. The Jews who believed that he would be enthroned in the heavens with Yahweh and that he was pre-existent. I just have a quick quote here from the book of 4th Ezra. I'll go past that. It says, I dreamt a dream in the night, and behold, a wind arose in the sea and stirred up all its waves. This is a passage from one of the apocalyptic writings of the intertestamental period, and it includes this Jewish view of this apocalyptic Messiah. It says that this man flew in the clouds of heaven, and further on in the highlighted text, he sent forth from his mouth, as it were, a stream of fire from his lips, flaming breath, and from his tongue he shot forth a stream of sparks. Again, just to give you some of the flavor of what these apocalyptic Jews were looking for in the Messiah, they weren't expecting a human being to come necessarily. They were expecting this divine apocalyptic warrior that would come and be enthroned in the heavens. So now, we've discussed some of these views of the apocalyptic Jews. We've discussed these views of the Pharisaic Jews. What were the New Testament authors' view of the Messiah? Was he a pre-existent divine warrior that would come and defeat his enemies with these divine powers? Or was he a mere human being that was born of the flesh only, and that he would come and defeat the Roman conquerors through human means? Well, in the book of Jude, we have a quote from the book of 1st Enoch. That Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men, saying, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment upon all, to convict all who are ungodly among them, of all their ungodly deeds which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. So here in the book of Jude, they actually quote the book of 1st Enoch. One of the biggest chunks of 1st Enoch concerns this pre-existent, divine, messianic figure who would be enthroned in the heavens along with Yahweh. To me, this proves that many of these Palestinian Jews, these first Jewish believers, were familiar with the concept of a pre-existent messianic figure. Yeshua himself identifies himself as the Son of Man a number of times throughout the Gospels, an undoubted reference to Daniel chapter 7, and a title reference time and again in the book of 1 Enoch that the New Testament authors were apparently familiar with. Just to quote one, it says, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides the sheep from the goats." So here it's talking about the Son of Man, of course, himself, this messianic figure who is enthroned, and along with these holy angels with him. This would be very significant to the Pharisees when they had heard this from the Messiah's mouth, because when he would say these types of things, they would think, this is the view of these apocalyptic Jews, this is heretical. Similarly, we read in 1 Enoch, "And he sat on the throne of his glory, and the sum of judgment was given unto the Son of Man." Virtually the same picture is painted between Matthew and 1 Enoch in this specific passage. Now, by no means am I saying that the book of 1 Enoch is inspired. I'm not saying that in any way, shape, or form. I'm just simply trying to use this as a source so that you can get an idea, a window into the mindset of some of these apocalyptic Jews. Further on in the book of Revelation, we read, "There shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him." So here again in the book of Revelation, there is this picture painted that the Messiah himself will be enthroned next to Yahweh, which was considered heretical by the rabbis of first century Judaism. So just as it would be incorrect to say that every first century Jew had an exclusive messianic expectation of a pre-existent divine warrior, so too is it wrong to say that every single first century Jew had an expectation of a purely natural human typological king. As we had noted earlier, there was no one orthodox view of Messiah. However, the expectation of a divine messianic figure is confirmed by scholar after scholar as being thoroughly rooted in first century Jewish apocalyptic thought and is not the result of Greek philosophical influence. I simply have one quote here from the book of Jewish Sources in Early Christianity from David Flusser, who was considered one of the preeminent scholars on Second Temple Judaism. And he says, "The sublime or divine conceptions of Christ the Messiah in the New Testament are, in most cases, not the direct result of Christian belief, but adaptations and modifications of Jewish beliefs, which were current in certain circles. The celestial biography of the Messiah found in the New Testament consists entirely of Jewish motifs. Jesus the Messiah had existed before the creation of the world." So here he plainly tells us that this was actually a Jewish motif of the Messiah existing before the creation of the world. Again, I have many other quotes, but I didn't include them in here. I didn't want to bore anyone to death more than they are already, perhaps. But the picture that I'm trying to paint is that the first century New Testament Jewish believers were familiar with this concept of a pre-existent divine Messiah who was enthroned with Yahweh in the heavens, and that it was the Pharisaic party of the rabbis that opposed it, and it is mostly their writings that we have to this day where the position is often taken that first century Jews were only expecting a human Messiah. For the Pharisees, that is true, and since they have the bulk of the writings that have been preserved for us today, that's often the view that is looked to as what were the expectations of the Jewish people in the first century. However, we have to keep in mind that there were a number of various Jewish sects in first century Judaism. Not all of them, certainly, were the Pharisees, not even by a long shot. In fact, the picture of Judaism today is more or less unified. You have Judaism, then you have a more liberal form of Judaism, and a more liberal form, and etc. But it's all more or less the same form of Judaism. It just gets continually more and more liberal as you look at the various parties. However, in the first century Jewish world, Judaism was very diverse. There were a number of various opinions that were represented, kind of like Christianity today, actually. So moving forward, I'd like to look at, we had discussed the two powers as perceived by apocalyptic Jews who viewed the Messiah as a pre-existent figure. What I'd like to do is move forward and look at these Jewish groups who believed in the second power, who viewed the second power as a mediatory figure within Second Temple Judaism. So first we looked at this messianic figure, now we're going to look at this mediatory figure of first century Judaism. Some of the points I'm going to cover in this section. The first century Jews had a tradition about a heavenly mediatory figure who was second only to Yahweh. This mediatory figure was believed to be the Old Testament angel of Yahweh, referred to as the Word among other titles in intertestamental Jewish documents. The characteristics of the Word included such attributes as being pre-existent, the instrument through which Yahweh created the worlds, and the mediator between God and mankind. The New Testament documents depict Yeshua as the mediatory figure who was portrayed in the Jewish tradition. The Pharisaic rabbis argued that it was heresy to believe the Word was a personal being who was separate and unique from Yahweh. The rabbis maintained that the Word was an impersonal projection or hypostasis of Yahweh himself, and that the Old Testament angel of Yahweh was a subordinate being named Metatron. And we're going to get into some of these points, or all these points, actually, throughout this section. So upon his first visitation, Yeshua came in the role of the mediatory figure between man and Yahweh. Again, interestingly enough, there were Jews of the intertestamental period who had a number of traditions about a pre-existent heavenly mediator who they believed was second only to Yahweh and who was also enthroned along with him in the heavens. Now, before getting into quotes from these primary sources of this intertestamental period, what I'd like to do is just look a little bit into the Old Testament, into the focus of many of these speculations, who was the angel of Yahweh. Now, this may or may not be a character that you're familiar with. I know that some of you definitely are, some of you may not be. Well, the angel of Yahweh appears primarily in the theophanies of the Old Testament. A theophany is just a fancy theological word that means places where God appeared to men. Nearly every place, especially in the Torah, talking about the patriarchs, the angel of the Lord appears to Yahweh as Yahweh. He represents Yahweh. He comes in the place of Yahweh to give the patriarchs Yahweh's message. In Exodus chapter 3, we read, "And the angel of Yahweh appeared to him," meaning Moses, "in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So when Yahweh saw that he turned aside to look, God called him from the midst of the bush and said, 'Moses, Moses,' and he said, 'Here I am.'" So here in this passage, early on in the passage, we see it says the angel of Yahweh appeared in the midst of the bush, but then it says Yahweh called to him from the midst of the bush. There appears to be some kind of mistranslation. You may suspect that somewhere in that dot, dot, dot that I've quoted that there must be a rational explanation. You can look it up yourself. There's literally dozens of these kinds of occurrences throughout the Old Testament, where first it says the angel of Yahweh did this, but then it says Yahweh did this. And sometimes there's confusion. Well, who was it? Was it the angel or Yahweh? I'd just like to refer to some more passages before actually going into how or why. Genesis 31, "The angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me.'" So here this angel of God appears to Jacob and identifies himself as the God of Bethel. Again, if you look up this passage, this dot, dot, dot that I put in there is just to conserve time. In any case, the angel of God represents himself as the God of Bethel in Genesis 31. So what I would like to do is to go back to that passage that this angel of God is referring to, where he says, "I am the God of Bethel." Where is he talking about? Well, earlier in chapter 28 of Genesis, Jacob had this dream. It's often called Jacob's ladder. In Genesis 28, we read, "Then he dreamt, and behold, a ladder was set upon the earth, and its top reached to heaven. And there were angels of God ascending and descending upon it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, 'I am Yahweh, God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land in which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants.'" So here, there is no indication anywhere that this angel is representing himself as Yahweh. It just says Yahweh, and Yahweh stood at the top of this ladder. However, going back to Genesis 31, it says, "The angel of God said, 'I am the God of Bethel.'" So the angel is saying, "I am the one that appeared to you as Yahweh." Again, you may think that maybe I'm misrepresenting this passage. Go back and look for yourself. There are literally dozens of these examples throughout the Old Testament. Further on in another passage, Genesis 32, we read where Jacob wrestles with this mysterious man. Early on in the passage, it says, "A man wrestled with him until the breaking of day." Then later on it says, "And he said," meaning the man, "'Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel.'" So this man renames Jacob to Israel. It says, "For you have struggled with God and with men." And then it says, "The man, he blessed him there." So here this man blesses Jacob and gives him another name, Israel. It says, "For," and then Jacob says, "I have seen God face to face." So the implication is that Jacob wrestled with God himself in this passage. However, if you refer back to the prophets in the book of Hosea, it says, "Jacob took his brother by the heel in the womb, and in strength he struggled with God." Reference to this passage that we had just read. "Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought favor from him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spoke to us." So here it's telling us in Hosea that Jacob actually struggled with the angel representing himself as God. And then later on it says he found him in Bethel. Again, another reference to this passage that we had read earlier. So again, the point is that this angel appears throughout the Old Testament, represents himself as God, appears to people, and the people believe they actually have seen God, does all these various things on behalf of God. I just have a very small list of them here. He swears to multiply Hagar's descendants of Hagar, and he's actually referred to as Yahweh. Speaks to Abraham in place of Yahweh, is asked to bless Ephraim and Manasseh, appeared as a pillar of fire and of cloud, the one who led the Israelites out of Egypt and made the covenant with the patriarchs, appeared to Gideon as Yahweh. Again, this is by no means comprehensive. There are passages scattered throughout the Old Testament regarding this angel. So how was it possible for this angel of Yahweh to fulfill all these roles that have usually been attributed to exclusively Yahweh himself? Well, the answer, I believe, can be found in the ancient Middle Eastern custom of the Shaliach. What is the Shaliach? The Shaliach is a term or a function in the Middle East where a person would represent the sender and would carry out business in the name of the sender. He would be dispatched to do perhaps business deals. In Abraham's case, he sent out Eliezer, I believe, to find a wife for his son. He would be functioning as a shaliach, be doing something in the name of the sender. And this was probably the case, or I think most definitely the case, with this angel. In fact, we're almost told this verbatim in the book of Exodus in chapter 23. It says, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you to the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land." So again, Yahweh says that he is sending this angel, that he will not pardon their transgressions, and that within this angel, Yahweh's name is placed within him, meaning that he is his representative. And it was actually this angel of Yahweh enclosed within this pillar of fire and pillar of cloud that led the Israelites throughout their Exodus journey. So thus the Jews concluded the following information about this angel. And by the way, this was not disputed even by the rabbis. The rabbis fully acknowledged that, yes, this angel existed. Yes, this was a special angel. We'll get into more on that a little bit later. So the characteristics of this angel. The angel speaks as Yahweh, identifies himself as Yahweh, exercises the responsibilities of Yahweh, such as forgiving transgressions, multiply seed, making covenants, blessing people. The angel bears the image of Yahweh. Again, this angel often appeared to the patriarchs, said, "I am Yahweh," and then later on it's revealed that it was actually this angel. As I said, you know, feel free to look these things up and you'll find that this was the case. Now this may seem to be somewhat confusing. How could this be the case if you're not familiar with this concept? But in actuality, it seems that this was actually a fairly common practice in the Bronze Age for perceptions of people that they had of their gods, that there was this high god and there was this mediator or go-between that went between the high god and the people. In one of the passages of one of the books I read concerning this, it says, "Other Mesopotamian nations had a high god with a second god as a vice regent in their council structure." And further on it says, "This second god served as the vice regent of the sovereign god. Israel adopted but adapted the high god vice regent structure of the council." So in other words, saying that the way that the ancient Israelites understood the relationship between Yahweh and this angel, it would not have been a hard time for them to perceive this. They would understand what this meant and that this angel was actually representing Yahweh on behalf of Yahweh. This wouldn't have been something that was foreign to them or confusing. So now the precise identity of this messenger of Yahweh is never actually given throughout the Old Testament, which led to much speculation on the part of the intertestamental Jews. When you read a lot of this intertestamental literature in what is called the Pseudepigrapha, which is a collection of mostly apocalyptic books, but other books written by Jews between the Old and New Testament. And when you read things from the Apocrypha, which we all are probably fairly familiar with that, you'll read a lot of references to this specific being, the angel of the Lord. There were a number of names and titles that this angel went by throughout their literature. He was called Yahuwel, the angel whose name cannot be given, the title Wisdom, the title Word, and Metatron. I'm not going to be going through all these names. There are just two that I'd like to focus on. The first one is Word. Why was the title Word used as a reference to this angel? The bottom line is people really don't know. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of conjecture on why it was used, and much of it is very good. But the one that I personally found most compelling is in Exodus chapter 4, where it says that Moses shall play the role of God, and Aaron would be as Moses' word, or his spokesperson, or his mouth. The translation is essentially the same in the Jewish Publication Society, that Moses would play the role of God, Aaron would be as his word, his spokesperson that spoke to the Pharaoh on behalf of Moses. And it's believed that many of the Jews saw the role that Aaron played as equatable to the role that this angel played between Yahweh and the people, that he was a go-between, an intermediary, a mediatory figure. Now, as for the title Metatron, what in the world does that mean? It sounds like a Japanese cartoon name, perhaps. Metatron was a name that actually was a Greek word which meant the one who stands behind the throne, the emphasis being on standing. Why was he called the one who stands? Because, again, as I said earlier, the Pharisees believed that anybody who was enthroned alongside Yahweh, that would be heresy. So this secondary being stands next to Yahweh. He's not enthroned. He is an angel of considerable power, yes, but an angel nonetheless that does not share in God's divinity. Therefore, he is not enthroned. So he is the one who stands beside Yahweh. Again, that's the term Metatron. So what I'd like to do is just look into a couple of references in the intertestamental books regarding this being. The first one I'd like to look at is the Book of Wisdom of Solomon. It says, "For while gentle silence enveloped all things, and night in its swift course was now half gone, your all-powerful word leapt from the heaven, from the royal throne, into the midst of the land that was doomed, a stern warrior." So here the word is referred to as being enthroned and was actually a stern warrior. I don't unfortunately have a lot of time to get into the Book of Wisdom of Solomon, but certainly the terms logos, word, and wisdom were used as titles for this angel of Yahweh. If you read the Book of Wisdom of Solomon, there are a number of passages that refer to the angel of Yahweh, except he's couched in the terms of wisdom and the word. What I would like to do is go into Philo somewhat. Philo can be seen of a Jew of questionable character, perhaps, of being influenced a great deal by Greek philosophy. But it's interesting that there are a number of scholars that are coming forward that are saying that's not necessarily the case. When you take all of the intertestamental literature as a whole, Philo, many of his passages and writings fit neatly into this Jewish interpretation of this angel of Yahweh as being the Word. I just have one passage that I had quoted from one of these books. It says, "The problem with Philo's writings is that he is not expounding the faith of his fathers in terms of his own culture, but rather is transposing it into the world of contemporary Hellenism. He uses the language of the philosophers, and yet time and again what he writes is not their philosophy. Philo was presenting the Judaism of his time in Greek terms, but what he was presenting was Judaism and not a vague syncretism. He used Greek terms for something which was essentially Jewish." So Philo was a Hellenized Jew who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, right about the time of Messiah and the Apostles. And this is when he wrote most of his works. What I'd like to do is just look at a couple of quotes from his writings. It says, "It was the angel who altered the name of Jacob, being the word, the minister of God." So here Philo clearly identifies this angel who altered the name of Jacob, which we had read earlier. It was the man who wrestled with him. Further on it says, "See whether there really are two gods, for it is said, I am the God who is seen by you, not in my place, but in the place of God, as if he meant some other god. What he declares God is his most ancient word." So what Philo here is quoting is this passage that we had read where Jacob has this vision of the ladder, Yahweh seen at the top, but then later on it said that this being was actually the angel of Yahweh. And here Philo is saying that this being is known as the Word. This angel of God was the Word. So further on in Philo it says that the Word was Yahweh's firstborn son, the lieutenant of the great king, essentially the second in command. And he quotes Exodus chapter 23. This passage that Philo quotes is actually, again, a reference to this angel of Yahweh. You can look it up. It's actually referring to the angel of Yahweh, whom Philo refers to as the Logos. And moving on, "And who is the heir of divine things?" Authored by Philo, it says that the universe has given to his archangelic and most ancient word a preeminent gift, staying on the confines of both and separate that which has been created from the Creator. And this same word is continually a petitioner to the immortal God on behalf of the mortal race, and is also the ambassador sent by the ruler of all to the subject race. And the word rejoices in the gift and exulting in it. In other words, what Philo is saying here is that the Word, this angel of Yahweh, is the mediator. He's the go-between between Yahweh the Father and mankind. And he quotes this Exodus chapter 14 as an example of where this angel stood in the midst. And the angel in Exodus 14:9, this is another reference to the angel of Yahweh again, if you look it up. So it's clear that Philo identifies the Logos as this angel of Yahweh throughout the Old Testament. I have one final quote where Philo believed that the Word did not in any way differ from the divine image. In other words, he bore the exact image and representation of Yahweh, which is why this word could appear to Yahweh, this angel could appear to Yahweh as God, because he was the exact image of God. And later on it says that he was the eldest son, whom he also calls the firstborn in Psalms 89:27, and that it was actually the word that shaped the different species. In other words, the word was the one that was responsible for the creation of all things. So if you look through all of Philo's writings, you'll see a number of characteristics and attributes that are prescribed to him that we primarily have associated in the past with the Messiah and the New Testament. Fairly uncanny, actually, some of these characteristics. But the question comes up is, was this word that was used by Philo and other Hellenistic Jews rooted in Greek philosophy? Or can we find the same kind of concepts written about in Jews that lived in Judea itself? Well, the answer is yes, we can find references to this in Judean writings. Primarily in the Targums you can find these things. In the Targum of Onkelos, the Fragmentary Targum, the Targum of Pseudo-Jonathan, the Targum of Jonathan. These dates that are given at the end of them are the dates of when these Targums were actually finalized, but they were actually originated between the 1st and 2nd centuries, and some scholars say actually even earlier. What the Targums were Aramaic translations of the Hebrew scriptures into Aramaic so that the Jews could understand what was being read. Many of the Jews, after they returned from Persian captivity, no longer spoke the Hebrew language. They understood Aramaic. So these things were translated into Aramaic for them. They were actually oral at first, but then later on they were written down, which is partly shows you why there are these later dates, is because originally they were actually orally recited. In any case, I'd just like to go to a few passages. It says, the word of the Lord was revealed upon the world as it was created, and the world was without form and void, and the word of the Lord illuminated it and made it light, and he called it the first night. So here it says that the word was actually in the beginning, and that he illuminated. He was the first one that said, let there be light. That was the word. Later on in the Targums we read, the word of the Lord created man in his likeness, and he blessed them in the name of his word. So here in this passage, it's actually the word that created man and woman. In another passage of the Targums we read, and the word of the Lord said to Moses, he who spoke to the world be, and it was, and who speak to it, and who will speak to it be, and it will be. This is actually a passage I pulled out where Yahweh is speaking to Moses in the burning bush. Here it says, the word of the Lord said to Moses, just as we had read in Exodus, where it says, the angel of Yahweh appeared in the bush, and it says, Yahweh spoke to Moses from the bush. Here it's identifying as, the word spoke to Moses from the bush. Further on, it says, the Lord was revealed unto his word, unto Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc. The name of the word of the Lord is not known to them. In other words, what this is saying is that word actually appeared to the patriarchs, not Yahweh himself, it was the word. Here it says, my word will be revealed to you in the thickness of the cloud. Remember, as I said earlier, the angel of Yahweh is who led the Israelites on their exodus from Egypt to Israel. And here it's calling this angel the word. It says, my glory I shall put among you, my word shall be unto you for a redeeming God. So here it's identifying this word as a redeeming God. And then further it says, the word of the Lord sits upon his throne high and lifted up. Again, this is very important for this doctrine of two powers, because here it's saying that the word is actually enthroned. This was very significant for the Pharisaic rabbis, who said that no one was enthroned in heaven except for Yahweh himself. These are not the only passages that have this usage of the word throughout their writings. There are literally hundreds of examples where these are used. I've listed them, some of here. This is from Targum of Onkelos, Jerusalem or Fragmentary Targum, the Targum of Pseudo-Jonathan. again, the word is used this way in hundreds of references throughout these writings. Again, if anyone's interested in looking at these charts, I can supply them later on. Now, what were the rabbis' views on this word? How did they perceive the word? Well, they said the word and the angel were not one and the same being. They said that the angel of Yahweh, whom they referred also as the lesser Yahweh or Metatron, was the most highly exalted archangel. The word was a hypostasis that Yahweh used to communicate with mankind. What is a hypostasis? Well, hypostasis is a very interesting thing to try to explain. They believed that this was actually an impersonal projection of Yahweh, kind of like this projector, actually. That what you're actually seeing is this projector, but what's being communicated through this projector is me. It's not a being unto itself, it's just an image, it's a thing that's a part of God, but yet not really God. It's kind of confusing. It's actually a Greek concept. In any case, they said that this word was a hypostasis of Yahweh. The word was necessary to avoid anthropomorphisms. What is anthropomorphisms? It's another big, long, 50-cent word that means that attributing human characteristics to God. In other words, God doesn't have hands and feet. God doesn't feel angry or sad or upset or happy. What we're doing is attributing human characteristics to God. And to the Pharisees, that was a sin, to the rabbis. The word did these things and acted these things out and was angry, had arms and legs that you could see and all these things because Yahweh didn't. And this is the way that Yahweh communicated with mankind, was through this hypostasis, through this projection of Yahweh that was not unto itself an independent being. As I said, this can be somewhat confusing and so forth. It is confusing, actually, because, again, it's an idea that's really rooted in Greek philosophy. In any case, throughout the Talmud, you can find that these people who believed in two powers used passages in the Old Testament which referred to the angel of Yahweh. In other words, the proponents of two powers said that this angel of Yahweh was a second divinity, and the rabbi said, no, it wasn't, because of these reasons. I'm not going to go through this whole entire passage, but that's basically the gist of it. There's this two powers proponent that's saying that this angel should be worshipped. It wasn't actually just an angel, it was actually a second god. We should worship him. And the rabbi was coming with counter-arguments saying, no, we shouldn't, no, we shouldn't, and this is why. But in any case, the point of quoting this passage is that in the beginning of the passage it says that only the very skilled should engage in debating the two powers proponents. In other words, only those rabbis that really had a good grasp of the scriptures should engage with these people because some of their arguments could be tricky, as it were. The two powers proponents used passages of the angel of Yahweh for their support, but the rabbis maintain Metatron, the angel of Yahweh, should not be worshipped. In other words, they're saying that this Old Testament angel of Yahweh was Metatron. He's simply an angel. He's the one that stands. He should not be worshipped. Now, there were rabbis who, despite these warnings, did adopt this belief system of two powers, that there actually was the second divine figure. And they believed that this second divine figure was, in fact, this angel of Yahweh, whom they referred to as Metatron, whom other Jewish groups refer to as the Word of Wisdom, Yahweh, etc. This passage that I have quoted here is of a person named Aher, called Aher. And this is actually a man named Elisha ben Abuya, who is considered to be one of the worst heretics of Pharisaic Judaism. And the reason he's considered a heretic is because he was a proponent of two powers as a result of a vision that he claimed to have had in the heavens. So here in this passage, Elisha ben Abuya, this rabbi, says that he has this vision of the heavens, and here's what he saw. Aher saw that permission was granted to Metatron, meaning the angel of Yahweh, to sit and write down the merits of Israel. He said, it is taught as a tradition that on high there is no sitting. Perhaps, God forbid, there are two powers. After his apostasy, Aher asked Rabbi Meir, saying to him, what is the meaning of the verse, God has made even the one as well as the other? He replied, it means that for everything that God created, he created also its counterpart. He created mountains and he created hills. He created seas and he created rivers. So in this passage, Elisha ben Abuya claims to have had a vision of the heavens. In this vision, he claims to have had the angel of Yahweh enthroned in the heavens, writing down the merits of Israel. The rabbi said this was heresy, what you said, to say that this angel of Yahweh is enthroned. Because when the rabbi said that he was enthroned, it not only meant that he was just sitting down, meant that he was enthroned in the heavens with Yahweh, sharing in his divinity. And this is exactly what the two power proponents had said also. So from that point forward, Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya was shunned from the rabbinic community because he adopted this belief system. From this passage, we could see that at least one rabbi broke ranks with the Pharisees and converted to the belief in two powers, and that believing Metatron was enthroned alongside Yahweh constituted heresy, according to the rabbis. This is all very interesting, the background of the Jewish beliefs between these apocalyptic, Hellenistic, mystical Jews who believed in this word, this angel of Yahweh being who was enthroned in the heavens, and these Pharisees who said, no, this wasn't the case at all, this is total bunk. What do the New Testament authors believe regarding this being? Well, in John 1:1, we have the Messiah being identified as the Word who is with God. The Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All these concepts we have seen in some of these other writings. And specifically at the end he says, no man has seen God at any time. Now the significance of this is that God appears to men throughout the Old Testament. Moses, Gideon, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jacob, Isaac. But here, John is saying that no man has ever seen God. Well, the reason that no man has ever seen God is because they actually have not seen the Father. They've seen the angel of Yahweh, who represented himself as God. Now, there's no indication anywhere in these passages in the Old Testament that this angel of Yahweh was actually some kind of hypostatic, impersonal, man-like projection of Yahweh, this hypostasis. It's simply presented that this was the angel of Yahweh as his representative. The idea of hypostasis itself originated in Greek philosophy. I submit that it was the rabbis who resorted to Greek philosophical traditions to explain what this word was. The only other character in the Bible who bears these same attributes as the Old Testament angel of Yahweh, if you go and look it up and write down some of these characteristics, is the Messiah in the New Testament. The angel of Yahweh was referred to in a variety of names throughout these intertestamental Jewish texts, just such as Yahweh, wisdom, but most importantly, the word. Is it mere coincidence the Apostle John also used the term word to describe the pre-existent state of the Messiah, a concept that his Jewish audience would have been somewhat at least familiar with? The word that John presents throughout his gospel is not a personification. He was and is an individual entity unto himself. Yeshua told his opponents time and time again of his pre-existent nature, and he was of the same kind of as Yahweh, that he had been delegated the authority to do things that were previously only regarded as being within Yahweh's command. Throughout the Gospels, we have various altercations that are recorded between the Pharisees and Yeshua. They understood him to claim pre-existence. They wanted to stone him because they believed himself to be declaring himself to be a god. They accused Yeshua of making himself a god because he forgave sins. They understood his statements that Yahweh was his father as meaning that he was of the same kind as or equal with Yahweh. The Pharisees, this is how they took his statements. So are we to believe that these conclusions the Pharisees reached were a series of blunders resulting from simple misunderstandings? I personally submit that the Pharisees were in a far superior position than we are to understand exactly what the Messiah meant when he spoke these words, especially when it concerns nuances of their own native languages and concepts. To view the Pharisees as the keystone cops of the Gospels is, in my opinion, a serious error. These men were the preeminent scholars of their time. They included among them such rabbis as Gamaliel, the direct disciples of Hillel and Shammai, and many other scholars who are venerated by modern Jews as the greatest Jewish minds of all time. That may mean nothing to some of you who aren't familiar with some of these rabbis, but these were considered the pinnacle of rabbinic Judaism to even Jews today. These men were absolute geniuses and the movers and shakers of Judaism, and this is actually what they practice today, are the teachings of these men. Is it really conceivable that the Messiah was crucified as a result of the Pharisees' mistaken impression that Yeshua declared himself to be the pre-existent and of the same nature as Yahweh? It was the Messiah's own declaration that he was the second power which led to his crucifixion. In Matthew 26 we read, "And the high priest arose and said to him, 'Do you answer nothing? What is it that these men testify against you?' But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, 'I put you under an oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.' Jesus said to him, 'It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven.' And of course their reply was that he had spoken blasphemy. What further do we need to have witnesses? Look, you have heard what he has spoken. It was blasphemous." There are three points I'd like to make out of this verse, and I'll wrap it up. In this passage, the Messiah uses the term Son of Man and coming on the clouds of heaven. It was a clear reference to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7 was a passage that was central to the two powers controversy. The title Son of Man was also used extensively in the book of 1 Enoch, which we reviewed earlier, that contained the concept of a pre-existent divine messianic figure who would share Yahweh's throne and defeat Israel's enemies through the use of heavenly apocalyptic powers. Secondly, Yeshua refers to Yahweh as the power. This is the only place in the New Testament scriptures where God is referred to as the power. The only other places that you can find this are in the parallel accounts of this circumstance. Is it a mere coincidence that Yeshua uses the self-same word which was used to identify this doctrine, perceived as heretical by the rabbis? And thirdly, he would be seated at the right hand of God. Of course, this was central to the rabbis' perceived heresy of this doctrine of two powers, that this second being would be seated next to Yahweh himself. The Pharisees' frenzied reaction to Yeshua's declaration of being the second power resulted in the accusation of blasphemy and that he should be executed. The scriptures, in my opinion, clearly depict the Messiah's crucifixion as a result of the rabbi's accusation of two powers blasphemy. The New Testament documents consistently present Yeshua as the pre-existent Word of God who will strike the nations with the sword of his mouth, in the tradition of the apocalyptic and mystical Jews who believed in two powers in heaven. And finally, to wrap it up, in the introduction, we reviewed the two foundational arguments made by the Unitarian position, namely that the first century Jews anticipated only a human Messiah, and that the divine attributes and characteristics being attributed to Yeshua are as a result of Greek influence and Greek philosophical ideas only. Although we've only scratched the surface, literally, with these different things that we've gone through, the information I've shared, I think, presents evidence that this was not necessarily the case. There were Jews who did believe in this pre-existent divine messianic figure and intermediary figure. Yeshua being considered divine pre-existent Messiah is consistent with the Jewish apocalyptic and mystical messianic expectations contained in numerous intertestamental writings of Second Temple Judaism. The belief that Yeshua was pre-existent, the instrument through which Yahweh created the worlds, and the intermediary between Yahweh and mankind is again consistent with the Jewish traditions of the mediatory figure whom they referred to as the Word. As we saw in Philo and in the Aramaic Targums, which are not believed to have any Greek influence at all, the belief had its origins in their interpretation of the Old Testament angel of Yahweh, whom they regarded as being enthroned with Yahweh in the heavens. John's use of the term Word in his prologue and in Revelation, in light of this Jewish background, demonstrates that he believed Yeshua to be the pre-existent mediatory figure between man and the Supreme God. Second Temple Jews who believed in either a pre-existent Messiah enthroned along with Yahweh or in a pre-existent mediatory figure based on the angel of Yahweh were considered two-power heretics by the rabbis before Christianity was ever even founded. Now, these belief systems are rooted in Jewish Old Testament interpretation and not in Greek influences. Although the descriptions of the New Testament epistles refer to Yeshua's divine qualities are consistent with the characteristics attributed in Second Temple Jewish tradition to the anticipated divine Messiah and the pre-existent mediatory figure. And finally, Yeshua's own testimony regarding his pre-existence and his unequivocal claim to be the second power resulted in his execution. I'd like you to consider what the likelihood is that every single time Yeshua spoke about his pre-existent divine status, that the preeminent rabbinic scholars came away drawing incorrect conclusions based on their failure to understand nuances of their own language. The rabbis were clearly not mistaken in their ability to understand Yeshua's declarations regarding his origins. He was crucified because of who he was, the pre-existent son of Yahweh, the king of the Jews, and the self-declared second power. Now, undoubtedly, there are problems with the Worldwide Church of God's understanding of binitarianism. As I said earlier, I do not subscribe to that belief system. I'm not of a Worldwide Church of God background. However, in my opinion, to adopt a Unitarian position kind of swerves to the other side of the proverbial pendulum. I do believe that some of these things can be reconciled together. And it's through understanding some of these intertestamental Jewish ideas and interpreting the New Testament in light of this Jewish background, I feel that we can really get to the crux of the matter. I found a quote that I thought was very appropriate in the Doctrine of the Trinity where it says, "The Bible should be studied in light of its own context and often with the help of those whose business it is to be informed about its background." I wholeheartedly agree with this concept. I think that if we look into some of this intertestamental Jewish literature, perhaps some of the questions that were asked earlier at this conference in the introduction by Mr. Westby, that we can find some of these answers to some of these age-old questions. For any of the information that I presented, you go to twopowers.org. I have all these charts, documents, etc. I plan to put more up in the future. But in any case, that wraps up the conclusion of the presentation. Let the stones begin.
Okay. It's interesting because I've done a lot of personal study with the intertestamental literature. I have both copies of the Pseudepigrapha. And one thing that's interesting... When I first got the paper, I just happened to look at one of the references of the latter chapters of First Enoch, and I remember that that James Dunn actually talks a little bit about it. Are you familiar with this right here? Okay. Well, I'm just read just a little excerpt out of here. He's talking about, as you said earlier, there are different parts of Enoch. The first 1 through 36 is one part, and then 37 through 71 is the second part. And he says here, quote, First Enoch 37 through 71, since these chapters have regularly been taken as the strongest evidence for the existence of a pre-Christian Jewish belief and a pre-existent divine individual called the Son of Man. Which you're proposing there. You're proposing that, well, it's probably, I think you said something like 1st century BC-ish. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he goes on to say that's a significant factor, however, is that in Cave 4 of the Qumran has provided fragments of every other section of 1st Enoch, but not one fragment of the similitudes have appeared. So he's saying that there's evidence that maybe it was the second part was compiled later, mm-hmm. because they have basically a whole copy or fragments of the whole first part, chapters 1 through 36. He goes on to say, basically, what we can say with greater firmness is that any hypothesis that depends on a B.C. or early A.D. dating of the similitudes may well be building castles in the air. As in, there's not a... From someone who I think has probably looked into Christology a little more than any of us in here, I think it maybe something worth considering that he says that Enoch, that second part of Enoch, which you quoted a lot of pre-existent Son of Man texts from, can't necessarily be pushed into the first century B.C. You had some more specific dates there, and I was curious as to where you got this from. But can you comment on at least this evidence right here?
on the fragments that were found of First Enoch in the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of the fragments that they found of these different chapters literally consisted of less than one sentence. They determined that by the context of the things that were being spoken of and by comparing it with the Ethiopic versions that they have extant today, that this is what it was quoting from. But we don't even have Hebrew originals or Aramaic originals of the Book of First Enoch, except for the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, to me, to say that because it wasn't found in there means that it didn't exist at that time, I don't think it's necessarily the case, because the fragments that consisted of First Enoch consisted of probably two pages. I mean, there was very, very, very little of First Enoch even found in the caves at all. And for that matter, I'm not building my case on First Enoch either. I mean, even if we could discount First Enoch altogether, there are still other intertestamental books. Well, if you look in the Pseudepigrapha, you'll see what I'm talking about, and read some of the introductions from, I think it's James Charlesworth that writes them, or most of them, that there's some other books also that refer to a pre-existent divine messianic figure. I chose First Enoch because that's the most widely recognized, and that's even quoted in the Book of Jude. But I'm not discounting, you know, his opinion. I mean, his opinion is what it is. It's his opinion.
Matthew 25:31. As being, you know, when the Son of Man comes in His glory and mm-hmm. sits on His throne and everything, but it would seem you can't sit there and say, well, it had. I mean, that's
no, I'm not just, saying it has
okay.
To come
okay, this it's. Yeah, I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I mean, if I wanted to take along some of these ideas, I need to find some more firm foundation. And I don't even think Charlesworth. I don't even think he dates that back there. And
he does actually. That's right now that you mentioned. That's where I get my dates from.
Okay, yeah, and it's his are a little maybe dated in a sense, some of the modern scholarship that they found.
Like 1910s or something.
Yeah, well, and another one on there, the Wisdom of Solomon or whatever, the one where you date in like in 30 or 40 A.D.? See, some people will date that even further towards the end of the first century, possibly the beginning of the second century now. So that's just a couple of things that I thought of. I was like, oh, well, if I'm wanting to take some of this over, I thought it was a big kind of pitfall.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, we only scratched the surface. Yeah. I would encourage everyone to look into this for themselves and draw their own conclusions. I would just point out that, let me just read this quote, because I think it's an interesting quote. I have quotes from various books up here for this purpose. It says, long before, this is from a man named Fletcher Lewis, who is teaches at the first, or at Oxford, which I don't know if you're familiar with him or not, but in his lecture, the first Oxford lecture on the development of Christology, it says, long before Philo, Greek-speaking Jews had used logos language as an alternative term to the angel of the Lord. As Gerald Fossum has pointed out, a key passage in this respect is Ezekiel the Tragedian's Exegod, in 96 through 99, which was believed to be authored in like the 2nd or 3rd century B.C. In this passage, Moses' encounter with the burning bush is retold, and where the biblical account has the angel of the Lord in the bush, Ezekiel has a divine logos. Logos language, then, is angel of the Lord language. Similarly, though, wisdom has had her own independent history within the Israelite culture. She has already been identified with the angel of the Lord long before early Christianity. This is clear from Sirach 24:4, where wisdom takes up the position of the angel of the Lord in the cloud of Exodus 14:19, and wisdom of Solomon 9:1-2, etc., where wisdom, logos, and angel of the Lord are equated. Wisdom and logos then both point to the importance of angelic categories as the common denominator in Jewish mediatory speculation. I make a point personally of trying to read some of these scholarly books of men that are very critical of the Bible and don't believe it necessarily as the inspired word of God, because they basically have no stake in the argument. They feel that, you know, this is a scholarly pursuit, totally intellectual, and as a result they have no personal feelings that have been injected into this controversy. They just simply look at the material and present it as they see it. So this is one of those quotes, but I have a bunch of them. They're also on that site, twopowers.org, if you're interested.
Brian, over here?
Yes.
I want to thank you so much for coming here. You really raised the bar in terms of presentation with the PowerPoint and everything, and you obviously have done an enormous amount of study. I want to thank you for sharing it with us.
No, I appreciate it.
I'm trying to crystallize your beliefs, and you've been very careful and very specific as scholars are, but I want to smoke you out a little bit, okay? Would you dispute that the mainstream of Jewish thought in the first century was unitary monotheistic?
It depends on how you term mainstream, because the Pharisees presented themselves as mainstream. Does that necessarily mean that the Jews at that time
would you dispute that most Jewish boys and girls in synagogue learned that God was one person?
In Judea, yes.
Okay. Would you dispute that the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, quite apart from intertestamental literature, that the Hebrew Scriptures are overwhelmingly monotheistic in their orientation?
I believe the whole Bible is monotheistic from Old Testament and New Testament, yes.
Okay. Would you dispute that Jesus could have adopted the Son of Man imagery from Daniel 7 without necessarily carrying all the baggage that came with various speculations in the intertestamental period? Okay. That's all I had. Thanks.
I would point out, I would point out that a lot of these references that are made in the New Testament to the pre-existence of the Messiah, vehicle to which the world were created, the Word, and all that, would be somewhat, I don't want to use the term deceptive, but misleading, if they were not referring to some of these Jewish traditions that they had about these areas of speculation among their own religion.
That's part of what I find so interesting about. I look forward to going to your website.
Thanks, appreciate it.
You know, obviously, I think, you know, we need to keep an open mind to all of those things to see if perhaps some different ideas can mesh together.
The unfortunate reality of this is that a lot of this material I presented is written by scholars that usually are not sub-translated into our own language, who have everyday jobs and, you know, work for a living. And, you know, it's so a lot of this material really isn't accessible to, you know, the typical modern layperson, yourself or myself. You have to really become familiar with some of these arguments, some of the terminology that's used to really grasp what they're getting at and what they're saying.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I also appreciate your presentation. I thought that was useful. I guess my biggest concern, though, is even if it were the case, as you presented it, that doesn't address at all the issue of that if Jesus was pre-existent, then how could he be fully human? And because he claimed to be fully man, fully human. So if you dilute that by saying he had pre-existence, then he was not human. And we have to have a fully human man Messiah. And as soon as you start saying he's God or had some pre-existence, the angel of God, you no longer have the purity of his humanity. So what are your thoughts on that?
I don't believe that he was fully God and fully man. I don't even feel that he was fully God as Yahweh was God. As I said, my interpretation of the Messiah's preexistence and his status as being the mediator between man and God, I don't agree with the Worldwide Church of God's position on that. I do believe that Yahweh is the one supreme, unique God, and I believe that Yahshua is the second to God. He is the intermediary between man and God.
Right.
So I do believe that I do believe that he was fully human when he appeared in the flesh. Do I believe he had preexistence? Absolutely. So in that mind, if that means that he was not fully human, then, you know, be that as it were, that's what I believe, is that he was preexistent.
I just had a quick question. Mm-hmm. Could I get your comments on Matthew chapter 1, verse 24, in which it says, Joseph awoke from his sleep and did as the angel of the Lord commanded him and took Mary as his wife. And this is, of course, after she was pregnant with Jesus, after the whatever incarnation mm-hmm. you subscribe to had occurred. So how is it that the angel of the Lord is still independently acting?
I don't believe it necessarily where it says every place in the Old and New Testament where it says the angel of the Lord, that it was this specific angel. The only place that this angel is really identified is when he appears to himself, reappears as Yahweh to the patriarchs, through some of these Old Testament characters, and so forth. So there are other places where in the Old Testament just says an angel of the Lord appeared to such and such a person. If that angel doesn't appear as Yahweh or present himself as Yahweh, or says, you know, Yahweh said this or whatever, I don't believe it was necessarily the same unique angel. Again, this involves the whole study into the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. And, again, we didn't have much time to get into that, so I really couldn't flesh that out fully. But.
Well, I just wanted to say one other thing is other than that is, first of all, it does have the definite article in this verse, Matthew 1:24. You know, it is the angel of the Lord, you know, whatever we want to make of that. And second of all, that quote you just read, where it, in essence, equated the Word of God, the wisdom of God, the angel of Yahweh, and I would also throw in there the name of God, the glory of God, and any other sort of way of referring to God. These could all just be ways of speaking of God in order to preserve his transcendence and also to express his eminence and action in creation without getting into any sort of complicated anthropomorphic questions. Yeah,
can certainly interpret all the Old Testament passages should you choose to do so. My focus was on what did the intertestamental Jews believe and how did they translate those passages, because I was trying to provide some background for the New Testament. Was it just Greek philosophical ideas that were reading into this, or could this have been possibly something that did originate from Jews from the intertestamental period? Thank you, appreciate it.
It was a very good presentation.
Thank you.
Just from listening to you, you seem to be more of an Arian than a Bonitarian.
Arians believe that the Messiah was actually created. I don't believe that. I believe that there was a point in time where the Messiah was actually born of Yahweh, and that he was literally the Son of God before time. That's actually what some of these intertestamental Jewish sects believe as well. And I believe that that's what the New Testament speaks of when it says that he was the Son of God. They referred to this word as the Son of God before he was ever, or they had no idea that he was incarnated in the flesh, in the Gospels. And they already perceived him as the Son of God, the eldest of the archangels, the Word, etc.
Okay, well, I don't know about the rest of them, but I believe God's Word interacted with humanity in various ways, through angels or the prophets. They spoke God's word. So the fact that it was the word of God in the Old Testament, I don't necessarily have a problem with. Hebrews says, though, that God spoke in various ways through prophets and angels, but in these last days he's spoken through his Son. So that indicates that in the past he hasn't spoken through his Son. So to equate the angel of Yahweh in the past with the Son doesn't seem to work.
Well, you can make that argument. I'm not prepared to debate some of these New Testament passages, so I could come up with some others myself, but unfortunately.
If this pre-existent being that you're talking about was not created, as you just mentioned, then he was uncreated. Not created would be uncreated. And so my question is, in what way can two eternal, uncreated beings be considered in any kind of familial relationship?
No, I believe that he was actually born of Yahweh. Anything else was created. I really don't feel comfortable talking about this, in honesty, because I've not presented any material whatsoever that covers that aspect of this argument. So I'm not saying don't ask your questions, but I would really ask that everyone confine their questions to this material, because then that's just going to get into areas that I, like I said, I didn't even cover and don't have adequate founding to even defend my position on.
One might argue that by bringing up the pre-existence idea, that you have indeed opened up the idea and covered the material. If you have a pre-existent being who is uncreated and another being who is uncreated, in what way could they be considered family? They cannot be related in any way, that a father or a son.
That he was actually born of father, meaning that he was his son before creation.
What's the difference then between created and born?
There's a big difference. I'm going to make a table. I'm going to get some wood, saw, start sawing everything together. My wife just had a baby. I did not put that baby together. It was something that issued forth from her body, that was of her, that was formed within her and issued forth from her. To me, I see a big difference between something that's created and something that's born. That's just my view. And perhaps you would view that as a rationalization of some sort, but that's my take.
So
yes, I do believe that he had a beginning independent from Yahweh.
Independent.
Well, our lunch is getting cold, or maybe it was already cold, you know. Now, how would you differentiate yourself from the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Jehovah's Witnesses believe that the Archangel Michael was...
But you don't name this angel. You just call him an intermediary.
Yeah, the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that Archangel Michael was an angel too, created just like every other angel and all that, and they don't have, we can talk about it afterwards, mm-hmm. but the specifics of the Jehovah's Witness doctrine and what I believe, they would call me a misguided person.
Well, join the club, you know.